pale and assassin. I'm a soldier. You're neither. You're an errand boy, sent by grocery clerks to collect the bill.
A bunker again, down where a friend is a friend. Yeah, Terrible Tommy here, back on Moon's Day after a short break. Yeah, how about that? Beautiful day here in Indiana. Got cool last night with 20 degrees last night. How about that? The frost was all over the pumpkin, I'll tell you that. Yes, yeah, so you know, we're at P.O. Box 401, and thank you for getting your donations for the show in. We had some more come in today. That's good. That's good. And a couple of you put in a little extra there for the POWs also. It is the 9th of November 2015. And tomorrow's my big day on the stage. The first stage out of town. No, I mean, I got to go in and plead for my sign out front. My political, religious, environmental sign that they want me to take it down, and I got to go in there and talk to the boys. I think what I'll do, I'll say, well, I'll move it, but I'm going to move it onto a trailer and take it downtown and park it around town for several hours every day. And would you like that better? Okay, you know. When I woke up this morning, I started to look out the bedroom window. Got Venetian blinds, but you can, you know, they're somewhat open. You can see through, and this blinding light was looking at me from about a half a mile away. And I thought, Jesus Christ, there's a flying saucer. And I couldn't figure out what this blinding light was. And so I got up and walked out on the patio, and I see my neighbor who's got a construction business. And he's got a big area where he parks all his heavy equipment stuff. It's about a quarter of a mile from me. Well, I guess maybe somebody's been pilfering his equipment. So he put this antenna or this tower up there, like about, I would say it's about 50 feet high at least. And he's got the brightest lights I ever see. He lights up the whole neighborhood, and that's good. I like a lit-up neighborhood, so I thought my security light on the front of my garage was enough, but boy, this really does the job. I'm going to tell him, I thought there was a flying saucer coming in here to pick me up. For a minute, I thought it was the moon, because sometimes, certain times of the month, the moon's out there in the west about that time of the morning, and it can be really bright, you know, but this was twice as bright as that moon. Now all he has to do is put out those Claymore mines and we'll be all set. Yeah, the whole area of the neighborhood is going to be covered. How high have you seen a chicken fly? I want to tell you, my neighbor got a few chickens and he sort of lets them free range around, and come home with my dog and let him out, that Siberian Husky, and for some reason he saw one of those chickens. There must be about 10 of them. And he was off like a rocket. I never saw chickens fly so high in my life. I know it was 20. One of the chickens was up there at least 15 to 20 feet. And I've been around chickens when I was a kid all the time. I never seen a chicken get that high. And they got away from him. I had to put him on restriction. She's not too happy about that, but we can't have him kill a chicken, because the very first dog I had when I was a kid, when I was about 6 or 7, he had to be killed because he killed chickens. And in the old school, and in the new school too, a dog kills chickens, usually you have to put them down. So that gave me bad memories. Well, I see the University of Missouri president has to leave his office. And for all the race-mixing crap that he's probably taught over the years, he probably deserves it, because he made one slip and said something that offended the the black boys. And so they got all upset. And, of course, all their white friends and their Jewish friends. And they got him fired. So most of them are rats anyhow, so that's fine. Fire their ass. Well, I think I got this white or Black Lives Matter thing figured out. Yeah, I do. And it took me a little while, but I had some clues. What we've got here is, I told you before, the government and the ruling class do not necessarily initiate any particular big problem in this country. But what they do is take a hold of one that's already started and write it for all it's worth. Then they have plausible deniability. Well, the riot in Ferguson, Missouri, or they wait till a cop kills somebody, whether rightly or wrongly, that's not the question, and then they get behind a movement like this. And what's happening is they're encouraging these blacks to riot more and more and more, and cry and cry and cry more. I think the whole thing is to set up so that the police are being bad-mouthed all the time, and they're always called killers and everything else. And they're going to push it so far that at some point, the progressives, who are always calling for the cops to be jailed, things are going to go to hell around this country. Who knows what it's going to be, mass rioting, and then the police, they're going to say, screw you. Yeah. Or they'll come down like a ton of bricks on all these people. It'll give them the excuse for a police state. Anyhow, all these progressives are always crying about the cops. The shit is the fan, and the cops don't show up. They're going to be really screwed. It's going to be funny. Yeah. So anyhow, that's sort of a false flag operation, I think. I think it's intended to do something much different than what you think. Another false flag, this Islamization of Europe and the EU. This is not an accident. Like I say, these things start out. Somebody kicks them off, and then if the powers that be, no matter who they happen to be, decide that's the one to jump on, that's the horse to ride, they get on it and ride. I think the one thing that I figured out on that is they want, the certain powers want the Islamization of Europe. They wanted it for a long time. And all you Hollywood Nazis out there, remember Hitler even played around with that, how great he thought the Islamic operation was. And he was quoted as saying things like that. I've seen something about that just recently. Well, looking a little farther into this Islamization of Europe, there's a book called The Islamic Resistance to Imperialism by Eric Wahlberg. And there's some interesting things in here. I'm going to read some of it. It's a long article. I won't read it all. Now, in the book here, with that analysis in hand, I tackled Eric's book with enthusiasm, I was curious, firstly, if the book could shed light on the questions I had about the human wave of refugees emanating from Turkey. As I write this, a new mass wave of 300,000 has been launched from Turkey towards Europe. I soon found this addressed on page 261 of Wahlberg's book, where Turkish thinker Dilipak is quoting as legitimizing modern Turkey as the heir to the Ottoman Empire and seeing the Islamization of Europe as a way of to bring these states into the fold of the new caliphate. Ahmet Davutoğlu, hard to pronounce these names, former Turkish foreign minister, was even more direct and is also discussed. His thesis, enunciated in 2008, is that the Ottoman reassertion should begin with the soft invasion of Europe through immigration, bringing Islam with it. Hold it. Wahlberg, under this doctrine, the EU would be transformed through multiculturalism, and Islam would reinvigorate Christianity. And Turkey would act as a catalyst for the world civilizational change. Just a minute here. This led me to another question I had as to the apparent deliberate action of Angela Merkel and the other EU leaders to actually facilitate this soft Islamic invasion via NATO member Turkey, and this Islamization of Europe, which had been on hold since the defeat of the Turks in Europe of the 16th century, apparently goes back as far as the bombing of the Serbs by NATO in 1999. Along these lines, General Wesley Clark, a former Supreme NATO commander, famously stated in that year, quote, "Let's not forget what the origin of the problem is. There is no place in modern Europe for ethnically pure states." Did you get that? No place in Europe for ethnically pure states. That's a 19th century idea that we are trying to transition into the 21st century, and we're going to do it with the multi-ethnic states. And that was from the general of the armies. The other thing is, look at it from the capitalist point of view. The aging population of whites in Germany has got the capitalists worried because their workforce is falling behind. But instead of mechanizing and robotizing and things like that, they want to shove all these Muslims into Germany to take up the labor strat. To take it up. And that's strictly a capitalist thing, too. And when you get capitalism together with a religious idea, you got a problem. The white working class gets screwed every time. Wahlberg, while I'm not sure he is familiar with the Clark statement, offers an explanation that accounts for apparently contradictory NATO position on page 278. Even the imperialists are beginning to recognize that Islam must be given a chance to rule, if only in order to sap the following of the violent alternative, unquote. Swedish Jewish activist Barbara Spectra has expressed fears that the Jews, instrumental in political implementing this demographic change, will be blamed for it by the anti-Semitic white Europeans. Well, of course they will, because they were part and parcel. They've been doing it for a long time. The book also answered questions I had as to why the idea of the Iranian-Syrian alliance so terrifies the House of Saud, which has aspirations to become not only the leader of the Ummah, but also the new Islamic caliphate, and Turkey, neo-secularist Erdogan, who himself has aspirations to recreate the pre-Sykes Pekat Ottoman Caliphate, and who along these lines has thrown in his lot with the Saudis and made overtures to Iran in his attacks on the PKK. Iran is predominantly Shia, and Syria predominantly Sunni. Unifying the two sects would be a prerequisite to any future Islamic caliphate, and this unification could potentially take place outside the control of the Turkish Saud NATO nexus. Importantly, Wahlberg shoots down the paranoia of Israel and its backers in the West over the intentions of Iran to head a new caliphate and conquer the Middle East. Iran will not head a caliphate or expand as feared because the Shia religious belief this is not within the power of the ordinary man. Such a kingdom must wait for the reappearance of the 12th hidden imam, also known by some as the Mahdi. Based on this belief and its level-headed and peaceful actions, Iran's political and military moves may instead be seen in the light of a simple preservation. I think much of its military response was to the unprovoked attacks in the U.S. and instigated Iran-Iraq war. Further, Wahlberg sees the view of the Shia in general to the caliphates founded after Muhammad as significant. Their view, he notes, is the Islamic civilization was flawed after the early period of the rightly guided caliphates, 1632-661, and the Sunni subverted the caliphate, Islamic governance, into a hereditary sultanate. With the author's understanding, we can infer how Iran must view the actions of Erdogan and the Sauds. The Salafist Sunnis, he notes, feel the same way about the alleged corruption in the caliphate by Shia for promoting the hereditary transmission via the prophet's descendants. Islamic resistance to imperialism seems cold to the Shia tendency towards inaction that, as the Salafists and the Wahhabis pointed out, allowed all sorts of corruption to flourish. But it holds up to anti-imperialist Iranian revolution as a positive development, citing Pakistani Kalim Sidaraki, 1931-1996, praised of this revolution as the way towards a renewal of the Islamic civilization, the harbinger of Islamic resurgence. In his view, Ayatollah Khomeini's political theory allowed a renewal of action in the Shia scholarship, and he urged convergence of the two facets of Islam, Sunni and Shia. What about the other players? Wahlberg perceptibly observes that unless they play second fiddle to Turkey, the Sauds will fail to keep the seat of the caliph, even with control of Mecca and Medina. Giving the Saud the designation of pre-modern, he notes they are nothing without the old Ottoman Empire behind them. Turkey's problem, after Erdogan's destructive meddling in Syria via proxy, will be that so much hostility has been endangered that Syria will be virtually impossible to assimilate in any Turkish caliphate. What about the neo-Wahhabist ISIS? The author sees them as rigid, non-inclusive, and essentially Saudi's sans empire. In a paradoxical way, though, he sees them as promoting Islamic unity by uniting Islamists of all stripes against their depredations. But this cooperation would no longer be under U.S. hegemony. As for the so-called U.S.-inspired color revolutions, Wahlberg sees return as each becomes progressively less successful and more counterproductive. The book winds down with a deconstruction of prevailing Western mythology about Islam and Christianity, that is, an offshoot of Judaism. Wahlberg cites Talmudic scholar Jacob Nausner in seeing the Judeo-Christian heritage as a secular myth. Wahlberg sees the term Islamo-Christian as a more accurate term for the Western civilization, which would certainly be more accurate than Judeo-Christian. If we talked about basic religious similarities rather than popular misconceptions, he feels Islam and Christianity should be natural allies against perversion and wickedness, which they should, but does not address the possible resentment of local populations to beatings, robberies, rapes by immigrants as a factor in Islamophobia. And these guys call the pot black, too. You know, look at all the crimes committed under the Saudis against their own people. But that's just improving Islam. Another cause of resentment I've read about, the high taxes paying for support of refugees' large families, while native European families have both white spouses working to pay for this largesse, who often cannot afford to have more than one child owing to child care and other costs, as in Sweden and Germany. The book further points out that in the U.S., Jews have had Talmudic courts for over a century with no public outcry, but for some reason, similar Islamic Sharia courts arouse great public concern. One is tempted to ask, however, if the Islamic proclivity towards integration without assimilation, which Wahlberg attributes to Islamic thinker Tariq Ramadan, might not contribute to this concern over a fifth column. Jews, even though de facto Israeli citizens, are adept at appearing assimilated in their host countries. Sadly, Islamic resistance to imperialism dances around the presence of Israel in the Middle East and how it benefits geopolitically from the self-harming and Dar al-Arb warlike destructive actions of the controlled imperialist powers, whose infrastructure, roads, rails, ports, bridges, dams, and waterways is deteriorating, and whose citizens mostly grow poorer year by year to fund extravagant militarism and benefits to the refugees caused by bad actions. Quote, "When do I get my house and car?" asked one Muslim refugee arriving in Germany recently. Apparently not having got the message that many white Westerners are now mostly unemployed and or poor and in debt and would have little or no net worth if liquidated. In the U.S., half of the 25-year-olds are still living with their parents because they can't find work. But in the book's last chapter, The Ummah in the 21st Century, Wahlberg summarizes what he sees as the strengths of Islam and its potential appeal to Christians, Jews, and Buddhists. A major strength he sees, quote, "The Rothschild-Clausewitz geopolitical laws underlie modern capitalism, economic control by the banks and war as bankers' ultimate weapon, both of which Islam rejects." He cites perennialist Jean Gouin's belief that modern civilization was overwhelming man's spiritual and metaphysical side in relating to the grand design of the natural world. In line with Foucault and Garuti, writes Wahlberg, he saw Islam as the only tradition that could resist this onslaught. The author calls for an end to sectarianism in the Muslim world and cites as success stories Iran's Islamic Revolution, Hamas, and Hezbollah, all of which are non-sectarian. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah is held up as an excellent exemplar of this hope, and quote, "We're not at war with Sunnis. We're both together at war with extremist groups like the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria," unquote. Nasrallah, the most popular Islamic leader, followed by Assad and Ahmadinejad, I can't read that. Wahlberg points out even backed Christian Michael Annan in a Lebanese presidential election. In closing, even if you disagree with Wahlberg's aspirations, I'd say to get this book and keep it handy if you want to have a deeper understanding of what's what's going on in the Middle East. But you see the handwriting on the wall. This is all planned. This is, you know, loosely planned to complete an Islamization of Europe and combining it with Christianity. The two great weapons of capitalism plus Judaism. So, what do you say to that, boys and girls? That's a little look into something a little different. And like I said, Hitler recruited thousands of Islamics into the Wehrmacht, as he did 54,000 Jews. So this idea that Germany was a racist country or had ideas of keeping it totally Aryan, I think is bullshit. I think that had Hitler won the war, this Islamization would have come on a lot faster. A lot faster. I would say keep an eye on Turkey. Keep a close eye on Turkey. Well, out of the Middle East and back into the good old USA. How about that? Let's listen to see about how the black ladies are doing in the street at the school.
An eyewitness viewer sent us video showing a brawl outside Cullen Middle School. The fight lasted for several minutes and then led to someone being run over with a car. All of it caught on video. Now, you may find some of those images disturbing, but Eyewitness News reporter Deborah Wrigley joins us live from the Texas Medical Center with that video and to tell us how the victim is doing tonight. Deborah.
Again, Tom, this morning, the video that will be shown is disturbing and it is violent, so watch at your own discretion. All this was, according to a family member, a girl fight outside Cullen Middle School this week. And it escalated. Now a 13-year-old girl is hospitalized here at the Texas Medical Center.
This man! Man!
This is the fight outside the school. A large group of girls swings at each other. And then, a few moments later, this happens. A gray sedan jumps the curb, steers onto the grass, barely missing some students, and hits and runs over that 13-year-old girl, who, we're told by her mother, now has a crushed pelvis, broken ribs, internal injuries, and she underwent surgery today. An HISD spokesperson says the district is aware of the accident, referred all questions to HPD. A spokesman there said there is no information available on this during the weekend. However, asked anyone who knows who may have been behind the wheel to please contact authorities.
I think that story came out of Houston. All these wonderful straight-A nigger girl students out there slugging it out, about 20 of them. And you can catch it on AP. The car runs over the one and drags her underneath the car down the street. These are wonderful people, just the kind of people you want in your neighborhood. Well, they're really going after Putin over there in Russia. Now, this story just broke out today about the massive doping and narcotics among the people in the sports field over there in Russia. Evidently, allegedly being backed by even state-sponsored stuff. And, of course, you can't believe any of this stuff. I hope that Putin has a handle on it, but if he doesn't, the U.S., of course, is going to use this as another club to beat Russia up with. But they may pull all of their sports people out of the Olympics next time.
Now point to a terrorist bomb taking down that Russian jetliner over the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt last month, likely ISIS-related.
Now, the easiest thing is to say this is ISIS, but what if it's not ISIS? What if it's a carefully planned CIA operation or something like that? Could be anybody. But you notice, if it fits the story and it's convenient for them, they'll say ISIS. Well, Maybe so, maybe not. And maybe what was behind this to try to, looks to me like they're trying to drive a wedge in between Egypt and Moscow, because hundreds of thousands of people from Russia go down there to the warm areas and beach areas of Egypt, and so they've got a very powerful bond there going economically too. So knowing the American CIA and the shit they pull, why not? Or maybe the CIA furnishing ISIS the equipment to do it. So think about that. Don't take anything for granted anymore. Don't take anything for granted.
Another blow to Russia's morale, the World Anti-Doping Agency finding top Russian athletes have participated in a state-sponsored doping program for years. All of this comes in the backdrop of a weakening Russian economy, in part due to international sanctions and lower oil prices. This, as Russia's President Vladimir Putin was just named Forbes' most powerful person in the world for a third year in a row. Garry Kasparov is a world chess champion as well as a human rights activist and author of Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. Garry, always great to have you on the show. Congratulations on the book. Very timely to have you on the show right now. What do you make of Putin topping the Forbes list of most powerful?
Kasparov, another Jew they're going to trot out to go after Putin. Yeah, all those old Jews that either got out of Russia or couldn't get out of Russia or something. Now they're going to bring them out of mothballs. Believe me, they're building a real head of steam against Russia right now. And if Putin's got dirty problems there, he better clean them up fast. Well, there's Hillary up in New Hampshire. Hey, Hillary, how you doing? Can you believe it? Out with the nigger, in with the what? I don't know what. Well, on this night, 77 years ago, seemed like just yesterday, when I picked up a rock and threw it, Germans stood by as the Jewish businesses and synagogues were burned. Tens of thousands of Jews were arrested, and nearly 100 were killed. Shouldn't doing nothing about it be criminal? Oh, I don't know. Well, let me see here. What the hell's going on here? I got to get to the bottom of the story here. This guy says, I'm a child of the Holocaust. Both of my parents are Holocaust survivors. Everywhere you go, there's survivors. This essay seeks to answer three questions essential to my understanding of the Holocaust, the bystander, and my understanding of the duty owed to another individual. Those questions are, what do we learn from the Holocaust in general, in particular from Kristallnacht, regarding the bystander? What is the responsibility of the individual in the face of unmitigated racism and hatred? What is the most appropriate application of the painful lessons that can be learned from the tragic events of November 9th and 10th of 1938. Gee, I was about 4 months old. On November, but I was there, believe me, I had my rock. On November 7th, 1938, a Jewish youth named Herschel Grinzenpahn shot the German diplomat Ernst von Roth in Paris. Of course, that was not a hate crime. Grinzenpahn's family, Polish Jews living in Germany, were ordered to be expelled by the National Socialist regime and transferred to refugee camps whose conditions were dire. Well, wouldn't, of course. Eye for an eye. Von Roth died of his wounds on November the 9th. Word reached Hitler shortly thereafter while attending a dinner commemorating his 1923 Beer Hall Putsch. Upon hearing the news, Hitler left the dinner speaking on his behalf. Goebbels, in essence. Wait a minute here. Called for a program directed against the Jews. The expression spontaneously planned has been used by historians to describe the unfolding of the events of the next 2 days. Of course, forget about the fact that this Jew gunned down the ambassador, diplomat. Within hours of Goebbels' words, more than 1,000 synagogues were set on fire and destroyed. In 24 hours, 91 Jews were killed, and over 30,000 Jewish men aged 16 to 60 were sent to concentration camps, where they were tormented and tortured for a number of months. More than 1,000 of those arrested met their deaths in the camps. Rampant looting and extreme violence in a hateful atmosphere marked Kristallnacht, along with the arrests and destruction of physical property, physical abuse, and humiliation in more than 1,000 cities, towns, and villages in Germany and Austria. Well, of course, you're not talking about the declaration of war made by the Jews much earlier. The Jewish worldwide boycott and attack on Germany. That wouldn't have anything to do with it, would it? Oh, it does? Oh, okay. According to the London Times, no foreign propagandist bent upon blackening Germany before the world could outdo the tale of the burnings and beatings, assaults on defenseless and innocent people, which disgraced the country yesterday, unquote. You notice that, how there are always innocent people? Jews are always innocent. There's never been a guilty Jew. Yeah. As hundreds of thousands danced in wild frenzy while millions watched approvingly, church leaders remained similarly silent. Well, churches are going to go. They're going to go their way however they see it's going to benefit the church. Over the past few years, this guy's scholarship has focused on extremism and intolerance, particularly in limits of tolerating intolerance. Well, I have become increasingly focused on the bystander because of the conviction that standing by passively facilitates extremism. So if 500 people are burning down a synagogue, one Joe Blow is supposed to jump in and save the day. The bystander is an individual who observes another in clear distress but is not the direct cause of the harm. A culpable bystander is one who has the ability to mitigate the harm but chooses not to. Needless to say, the age and ability of the actor must be taken into consideration. Well, I wonder how many Jews walk down the streets of New York and see a nigger beating the hell out of either another nigger or another Jew or an Aryan and does something. How many you think would do that? How many have done that? Horse shit. This guy's full of shit. In the course of my lifetime, I have, like many others, been faced with the dilemma of whether to involve myself when others are in need of assistance. Similar to others, I have made right and wrong decisions. The former are not worthy of discussion. The latter weigh on my conscience. Jews have all kinds of conscience. Oh, hell, that's enough of that. That's enough of that crap. You know, it's always the Jew boy. Jew's innocent. We never do anything. And what you should do if something like this happens on your street or your community, what you should do, not what I should do. But my conscience does bother me a little, but I have a couple of drinks and I can sleep at night. That's what he says. Well, I guess Netanyahu met with the chief Negro today or yesterday. And I saw a picture of them together. I don't know where it was, yesterday or today, but the look on Obama's face was pure hatred, and Netanyahu's looking down. It was a great photo. If I find it again, I'll send it to you. Now, you know this alleged hatred that Obama has for Netanyahu is not anything about the overall racial thing or anything like that. It's strictly he's in power, and Netanyahu's screwing him up. And Obama keeps screwing up in many areas. And he sees Netanyahu, nitwit, as a fly in the ointment. So he hates him. More about personal power than anything else. There's a website, and they send out information called Counter Bias. But it's so biased the other way, it's hard for me to have any dependency on it. Because they make every little thing that happens in the world a Jew thing, you know? And that's not the way it goes. Everything that happens, the Jews did it. You can't depend on news like that. You got to dig around. There's jerks on all sides. Sure, plenty of bad Jews around, but when a group, that's all they want to do is blame everything on the Jews, I'm suspicious. I'm going to play you another little thing here, which goes along with this thing of what they're setting up, the cops and the Black Lives thing. And there's nefarious people on all sides of this story. And they're going to keep hammering the cops. And at some point, the cops will start hammering back. But anyhow, listen to this.
The blue wall of silence. Claims he has secretly recorded tapes proving the department has a quota system and is manipulating crime statistics.
Adrian Schoolcraft is a New York City policeman who decided to secretly record himself and his fellow officers on the job, all day, every workday, he says, for 17 months, including lots of days when he was ordered to do all kinds of things cops are not supposed to do. It led to a small scandal, several people removed from their jobs, and four investigations of the New York Police Department.
I wasn't meeting their undocumented quota, the non-quota quota.
Officer Adrian Schoolcraft, an eight-year veteran, spoke about how a top-down pressure to make summons quotas corrupted policing in the 81st precinct.
Adrian Schoolcraft says he isn't exactly sure when, but at some point it is.
Now, remember, this guy, I'm almost positive, is a Jew.
Decided that it was important to document the orders that he was given, that he thought were out of line. He recorded roll calls where officers were constantly being told to do more stop and frisks, even though it's illegal to stop a random person on the street and frisk them without reasonable suspicion. In December 2008, a sergeant tells officers to stop and frisk, quote, anybody walking around, no matter what the explanation is.
They were just react. When they grab bodies off the street, when the inspector refers to them as bodies, how many bodies have I got in the cells?
Schoolcraft says day in and day out, it was all about the numbers, with little respect for people's rights.
I want 250 to see something. I want a ghost town. I want to be able to echo one end of the street to the other. You understand? That's what I want in a perfect world.
What happens next to Adrian Schoolcraft is very, very strange. Just a few weeks after his meetings with Internal Affairs and QAD, he shows up to work at the end of October.
As soon as I sit down, a lieutenant approaches me and asks for my activity log. Well, this activity log is where I keep a lot of my notes regarding what people are saying and the times they're saying it.
And all the things, basically, you're trying to report that
Correct.
You think are going wrong in the precinct.
Correct. And it wasn't until I got it back that I realized the cat was out of the bag. He had bent the corners on some of the pages, and I saw what piqued his interest. And I became very worried how he was looming around me. I felt threatened by it. I'm not just an officer inside. Now I'm an officer that has this psych issue. No one's supposed to know, but everyone knows that when you have your gun and shield taken, you've been psyched, and you have that brand on you. So what's going to happen? Are they going to say I lunged at them? Are they going to, any kind of scenario could play out, and I just didn't feel comfortable, so I left.
How he left, it's in dispute. Schoolcraft says that he told a sergeant that he was feeling sick and went home an hour early. The police say the sergeant never said yes to this request. In any case, Schoolcraft went home and went to bed.
A few hours later, I received a phone call from my father, and he told me he received a phone call from my XO. He says, look outside your window. And I looked out my window, and there were multiple police vehicles, and it just seemed to be quite a crowd.
Adrian has no idea what they want, but he knows the situation is bad, so he starts recording.
31 October 2009.
The officers open Adrian's door, the key they get from his landlord.
Adrian! Police department, buddy! Let me see your hands.
They've just entered my home, and they were in their helmets and gear and tasers. They had the special weapons, basically SWAT.
I can normally get up and answer, but they were kicking on that door loud and yelling.
I wasn't feeling well.
All right, sit down. Sit down.
That voice you just heard in Adrian's bedroom is a man of much higher rank than anybody in any of the recordings to this point. He's the number two commander for the NYPD for all of Brooklyn North, Michael Marino. Stephen Mariello, the head of the 81st Precinct, the commander that Adrian contends had been putting pressure on all the officers to deliver better numbers, is also there in the bedroom. He talks next.
You got everybody worried. You worried about your safety, right?
Worried about what?
We worried about what? They tried calling you. Everybody's been calling you. You just walk out of prison. You know? That's what we're worried about. Your safety, your well-being.
All right, I'm fine.
Why does he keep saying that? He's worried about your safety.
That's his excuse to come into my home.
Get your stuff on and going back to the prison.
I'm not going back to the prison.
Hey, you gotta go back to the prison.
For?
Because they're gonna do it the right way. You can't just walk out of command.
What's gonna be done if I go to the 8-1?
What's gonna be done? We're gonna go investigate why you left.
I tell me why I left. I was feeling sick.
Adrian, that's not the reason why you leave. All right, you know that.
Adrian knows the rules, and he asks if he's under arrest. He's not under arrest.
You get up like a man and put your shoes on and walk
like
into that bus like a man. Well, son, they're going to treat you as an EDP, and that means handcuffs, and I do not want to see that happen to a cop.
EDP is
emotionally disturbed person.
I'm laying right here until I feel better.
Okay, son. He's EDP.
Now that Deputy Chief Marino has labeled Schoolcraft EDP, the police take Schoolcraft and commit him to a psychiatric ward, saying he was a danger to himself. Schoolcraft had spent months documenting his bosses telling cops to lock people up on contrived pretenses, now found himself locked up on contrived pretenses. Schoolcraft assumes that he'll never again work as a police officer anywhere. Is it weird not to be a policeman anymore?
It feels odd.
Yeah.
But I still feel like I am a policeman. I'm going forward with this investigation. I just feel like this is my case. This is the one. And I'll go all the way with it.
And finally, with the 81st Precinct under new supervision, the numbers in serious crime have risen by 10 to 15%. Either crime's going up, or that's closer to the true amount of crime that was already there, only now being reported.
Are you going to take sides? You fool! Don't take sides. These guys, believe me, they've brutalized our people a hell of a lot. They've ramrodded against our people, and they persecute them and torture them in jail and everything else in prison. So don't take the wrong side. Both sides deserve what they're going to get. So let this thing play out. Let the black lives count more. I say white lives count more. I got the sign out there that proves it. So anyhow, but do not take sides. I know. You may know a good cop or two. They're around. But they're part of a system, semi-police state system. They can't be trusted unless... We have our people in there behind the scenes. Now that would be interesting, and probably is. But our friends, our lone wolves, would not be goaded into beating and torturing people. We're not like they are. This outing of the Klan is getting to be is getting to be hilarious. Let me play a little bit of this for you. This anonymous outfit. It's funnier than hell.
Anonymous has begun its leak on the identities of members of the Ku Klux Klan with a data dump that includes names of more than 350 alleged members, along with links to social media accounts. Many of the identities are already in the public domain. Many in the release are already in the public eye, at least on social media. The Twitter biography of one such Klan member, James Pratt, says... A veteran, a daddy, a Klansman of the traditionalist American Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Anonymous's war with the KKK began during protests after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri last year, when a subgroup of the KKK passed around leaflets threatening lethal force against protesters.
What's hilarious about this is that even back when I... Till 1980, when I was in the Klan from 75 to 80, 90% or maybe 99% of the Klan, they didn't give a shit whether you knew who they were or not. You come up and ask them if you're in a Klan, and they'd say, "You don't like it, buddy?" And they'd poke your eyes out because they were mostly skinheads. So this is funny. They're going to expose these guys. And good luck finding an address for a lot of these guys because they don't have one. Well, anyhow, several reporters and media groups displayed questionable news judgment this week. There is no news out there, no real reporting. When they gave credence to a person on the internet who claimed to have discovered that there are 4 card-carrying members of the Ku Klux Klan currently serving in the United States Senate, well, what the fuck would they be doing it in that crazy house? That would be some, quote, Ku Klux Klan data revealing alleged members of the KKK, including mayors and senators, released, unquote, the Huffington Post said in a headline this week. Those guys, those progressives go nuts. They go absolutely nuts. I know even have Mike Malloy, who some of his stuff I could use, but he go crazy. Over white supremacy, they're going crazy, man. And so they even had the senator from my state here, U.S. senator, said he was in the Klan. I think it's great. In fact, I think that may very well be a false flag operation there too, you know. I think that Anonymous could very well have been taken over by the opposition, or whatever the opposition is. What in the hell is the opposition anymore? All these big progressive magazines and web people have jumped onto this thing. Like Salon is a big left-winger. Hoods Off 2015 in full effect as Anonymous publishes the name of KKK members, including 4 sitting U.S. senators. Headline in Salon magazine. I used to think that might have some interesting things in it, but The Root reported elsewhere that the hacktivist group Anonymous has published the email addresses and phone numbers of supposed Ku Klux Klan members, including the names of 4 senators and 5 city mayors. Well, what I'm waiting on is to let's start outing the Anonymous people. Yeah, that's going to be funny too. I think Hillary Clinton is definitely in the Anonymous group. But don't tell anybody I said so. This country is run on hysteria, paranoia, and fear. And it's getting worse. It's getting worse by the day. But that's good, because you know what I say. Worse is better. I wouldn't doubt if they would out Obama as a secret Klan member. I mean, there's been blacks in the Klan and signed up and got membership cards and everything else. Maybe Obama's a secret Klansman. You know, you don't want to have anything to do with those unwashed ghetto niggers. He likes to hang out with white people. As it turns out, none of these reports are accurate. Anonymous had nothing to do with listing the 4 senators as members of the Klan, and there's nothing to prove that. AMPED attacks list the Klansman lawmakers, which includes a Roman Catholic and an openly gay person, is in any way legitimate. Well, hell, I've known, I was a Roman Catholic when I first joined the Klan. A lot of Catholics in the Klan down in Louisiana, the Knights of the White Camellia was all Klan, all Catholic. And gays? Not only the gays, but the Hollywood National Socialists, there are plenty of gays in there. Sorry, boys, I hate to pop your bubble.